you know, my hope is that we pass an operating budget as quick as we can and take that off the table, not so it's a bargaining chip or anything.
The special session opens in Juneau with high hopes but no guarantees. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, May 23rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, BP announces plans to sell its building in Anchorage.
I guess it's not a big surprise, you know, given prices, and also, of course, they have lots of other expenses that have hit them over the years.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka encourages rural Alaska high school students to apply to be part of their 70-year legacy. Mount Edgecombe High School provides a curriculum rich in culture and diversity, offering over 80 courses from art to advanced engineering and with activities from native dance to kayaking. Class sizes are no larger than 30. Explore your talents and develop your dreams. Apply online at mehs.us. This message sponsored by Mount Edgecombe High School.
Lawmakers met in Juneau today for the first day of the special session. Governor Bill Walker called the legislature back to work after it failed to pass a budget by the constitutional deadline last week. Lawmakers now have 30 days to try to accomplish what they couldn't do in the last 4 months, pass a budget and make some progress on closing the state's $4 billion deficit. APRN's Rachel Waldholz is in Juneau this week. And Rachel, it sounds like it was a short day there.
Yeah, it was definitely a short day, and there really wasn't much action, at least in public. The House met for about 20 minutes, and the Senate met for less than 15 minutes. And they basically introduced some of the bills that the governor has asked for, and they adjourned. And so the big question at this point is whether they're going to pick up pretty much where they left off last week, or if they're going to have to start over. Because when the regular session ended at midnight last Wednesday, all the bills that hadn't been passed died, but they can be brought back to life. It takes a two-thirds vote in both houses. And so the question is whether they can get that two-thirds vote. And that's really what the Republican leadership would like to do, because if they don't get that vote, then they have to start all the bills over and go through the whole committee process again. And then it's really going to be a real slog.
Yes, that sounds like it would be. Do they have a plan for how to make the next 2 months any different from the last 4 months?
Yeah, the short answer there is no, it doesn't seem like they do. James Brooks, he's a reporter with the Juneau Empire, and he asked House Speaker Mike Chenault what the next 2 weeks will look like. And this is what Chenault said.
I have no clue. You know, my hope is that we pass an operating budget as quick as we can and take that off the table, not so it's a bargaining chip or anything, but just we get it off the table, employees know what's going on. And the state knows what's going on, the people of the state.
So you heard him mention employees and the state, and that's because the legislature is facing two deadlines. If there's no budget by June 1st, which is next week, then layoff notices are going to go out to all state employees, letting them know that they might be laid off at the end of the month. And then if there's no budget at the end of the month, by July 1st, then the state could face the possibility of a government shutdown. So the Republican majorities, what they'd like to do is they'd like to just pass an operating budget and fund it with savings for now, and then go back and deal with some of the more contentious revenue issues, like restructuring the permanent fund to use some of the earnings for state government, or looking at taxes, including an income tax. They'd like to do that after they've passed a budget.
Rachel, does that seem likely?
Well, Chenault said that the two sides were really close on a budget last week, and he seems to think that they could get a budget done, by next week. But there are three factions that have to agree. It's the House majority and the Senate majority, which are both controlled by Republicans, and then there's the House minority, which is controlled by Democrats. And I spoke to House Minority Leader Chris Tuck, and he said basically his caucus can't vote for a budget unless there's some kind of agreement on an overhaul of oil and gas taxes. This is what he said when I asked about getting a budget done this week.
It all depends on what we do on the oil tax credits again. That was the point of contention, that we could not get a budget passed in the regular 121-day session, if you will. And we just can't see dipping under our savings to give to the oil industry.
Rachel, what is on the schedule for tomorrow? Are lawmakers lining up hearings so that they can get started on these bills and get to work?
Yeah, there are hearings scheduled for tomorrow. They've been announced sort of over the course of the afternoon today. So House Finance will be taking up the governor's proposal to raise taxes on, you know, everything from smoking and alcohol and tobacco to including an income tax. So House Finance will be looking at that, as well as the governor's plan to sort of restructure the permanent fund. And the Senate Finance is also meeting. So it looks like it will be a busier day tomorrow than it has been today.
All right. Well, thanks so much for that update, Rachel.
Thanks, Lori.
That was APRN's Rachel Waldholtz reporting from Juneau. Personnel and per diem costs tallied for the recently ended extended legislative session so far total about $520,000. That's according to figures provided by Jessica Geary, the Legislative Affairs Agency's finance manager. The biggest piece of that was for the daily allowance allotted lawmakers, known as per diem, totaling more than $407,000. Other items included payroll costs and staff per diem. Geary says by email that not all staff per diem claim forms have been received, so those costs will likely rise. The extended session ran from April 18th to May 18th. BP announced today it's selling its Midtown Anchorage building. In a statement, the company says the sale will reduce costs and free up capital, allowing BP to focus on its core business. BP will become a tenant in the building rather than the owner in what the statement describes as a real estate transaction. BP spokesperson Don Patience declined an interview request about the sale. The building was opened in 1985 and is assessed at more than $80 million. State labor economist Neil Freed is reluctant to draw any major conclusions on the future of Alaska's oil industry based on the sale.
I guess it's not a big surprise, you know, given prices and also, of course, they have lots of other expenses that have hit them over the years.
The sale doesn't include the BP Energy Center. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, family bonds that go much deeper than skin color.
They didn't associate me and my parents as part of the same family. It was that I was the black person and they were the white people.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive education grounded in real-world experience with life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. Apply now for fall 2016 and find out more about APU's Promise Tuition Grant and other scholarships at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU. Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettesworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
Electric energy is a fundamental factor of modern life. But in rural Alaska, the cost of keeping lights on and machines running is extraordinarily high, putting villages at an economic disadvantage. As KUAC's Robert Hannon reports, last week a federal administrator passed through the University of Alaska Fairbanks to review a project that aims to draw down energy costs in smaller communities.
The project explores microgrids that allow communities to exploit new technologies by either drawing down energy costs or becoming self-sufficient. Mark Mueller-Stoffel is a research professor at UAF's Alaska Center for Energy and Power, or ASAP. His team takes a holistic look at communities, examining possible alternative energy sources like wind, to recently designed batteries to store electrons, to using computers to oversee energy usage.
People flick a switch and they want stuff to run, and instead move it towards more of a supply-driven system, which can make things cheaper because then you don't have to store excess electricity and provide it later.
Mueller-Stoffel says ASAP also ensures new technologies are robust enough to withstand Alaska's climate. That approach attracted a $500,000 grant from the U.S. Economic Development Administration. Matt Erskine is the federal agency's chief operating officer. He toured ASAP last week. He says microgrids hold out the promise of putting Alaska villages on a better economic footing.
As you look at the future, new technologies, emerging industries that build on the strengths and the natural assets of Alaska, but also help in terms of economic diversification and quality of life and sustainable prosperity, I think is key.
Both Erskine and Muellerstoffel say Alaska's challenge to power widely dispersed villages also potentially puts a state on the cutting edge of new technologies that can be exported throughout the world. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
State and federal fishery managers have released the 2016 outlook for salmon runs in the Yukon River drainage. The Yukon King Run is again expected to come back weaker than average this year, with a similar array of fishing restrictions as years past. No commercial fishing opportunities are planned, and subsistence fishing will be significantly restricted, though possibly a bit more open than the past few years. The predictions for summer chum on the Yukon call for an average to above average run, meaning directed commercial openings with selective gear types like dip nets, beach seines, and live release fish wheels are likely to occur, targeting the abundant summer chum while allowing king salmon to escape to their spawning grounds. Beach seines will be officially regulated on the Yukon for the first time this year after the Board of Fish in January set limits to a beach seine's length, depth, and mesh size. Fishery managers expect a lower-than-average fall chum run up the Yukon, but not low enough to threaten escapement needs or subsistence harvests. Fish and Game Yukon Fall Fishery Season Fishery Manager Jeff Estenson says computer models predict a fall chum run of around 660,000 fish based on escapement data from 2011 and 12, when most of this year's returning fall chum were born.
That forecast is below average for an even year. It's important to note that, you know, over time, the even years tend to be lower years in abundance than odd years. And the average run size for even years over the years is about 800,000 fish. So even if we did hit the upper end of our forecast range, it would still be slightly below average.
In contrast to fall chum, the coho run on the Yukon is predicted to be average or above average, in keeping with strong coho returns over the past 2 years. Last year's commercial harvest of Yukon coho was the largest on record. But Estenson says if the fall chum run is not strong enough to permit commercial openings, then fishermen seeking the higher-priced coho will be largely out of luck.
Up through August 31st, it's a fall chum commercial fishery, and any kind of commercial openings during that time is solely based on assessment of the fall chum. So if you were to ever run into a situation where we couldn't fish for fall chum, under the current regulations that we have in place, we would not be able to have a coho-directed fishery.
Commercial openings to target coho salmon can happen from September 1st through the 10th, according to the Fish and Game Yukon River Coho Salmon Management Plan. This year, we'll also see the introduction of a pink salmon commercial fishery on the lower Yukon. The Board of Fish created a new set of regulations specifically applying to pinks, allowing the use of 4 3/4-inch mesh nets from June 15th to July 31st in District 1 at the mouth of the Yukon. In 2012, the Juneau Homeless Coalition identified 55 of the most vulnerable homeless people living in the community. Since then, 9 have died. Now, a project designed to give permanent shelter to that population is breaking ground. KTOO's Rasha McChesney has more.
Technically, the dirt is already moving on Juneau's Housing First project. Still, more than 100 people crowded into a warehouse in the capital city to celebrate the groundbreaking of a facility that is designed to get the area's most vulnerable homeless off the streets. On a lot donated by the Tlingit Haida Regional Housing Authority in an industrial area of Lemon Creek, the first support pilings have been drilled into the ground and contractors are working to install the foundation of the 32-bed facility. On Monday, there was food, music, and celebration of several years of effort and interagency cooperation to get the innovative housing facility into the ground. But organizers have not yet reached the finish line. The project is not fully funded. Maria Lovishuk, executive director of Juneau's homeless shelter, The Glory Hole, says organizers at Juneau's Housing First Collaborative are still about $1.7 million short of their goal.
So yeah, so we're kind of going on faith here.
Lovishuk says the coalition is waiting to hear back on 3 grant applications. Meanwhile, they're still taking donations through the Juneau Community Foundation. Proponents of the project say the new shelter will save lives. In 2012, the Juneau Homeless Coalition surveyed 55 of the most vulnerable homeless people living on the streets, in cars, under bridges, or in the forest around Juneau. More than half identified as mentally ill, while 96% of them had substance abuse issues, according to the survey. Since then, Lovechuk said, 9 of those people have died. Supporters of the Housing First model say that if a homeless person is given a permanent, stable place to live, it's easier to address issues like a lack of income, substance abuse, or mental health. But, as the 2 other Housing First facilities in the state have learned, it isn't always easy to get someone into a home.
For many of them, it was a huge adjustment. And it was kind of like the Wild West in the beginning.
That's Colleen Ackerman, program manager at the Carluck Manor Housing First facility in Anchorage.
Everything that you would imagine would happen when we have 46 people, many of them drinking, people passing out in the hallways and inappropriate behaviors and all that. So in the beginning was probably the toughest because it was all very new to the staff. It was new to even our division, even though we've been working with the homeless folks for a while. But now we've learned a lot of lessons.
Among those lessons, Ackerman says, is that Anchorage's Housing First program is a bit more restrictive than others in the country.
We learned early on that when we brought in too many visitors, many of them were intoxicated along with the tenants, it got pretty crazy. And, you know, the visitors became even more of a problem, and it just is too much safety risk. So immediately we did not allow more than 10 visitors in the building at a time. We had visiting hours.
Staff at the manor also don't allow residents to bring in more than 1/5 of hard liquor at a time.
They can bring in beer until the cows come home. I mean, they can't really carry that much anyway.
They'll also try to confiscate alcohol if residents are extremely intoxicated or aggressive. Other challenges include tracking down homeless people on the waiting list to get into the facility. Once found, Ackerman says tracking down paperwork like social security cards or driver's licenses can be a problem. Still, Ackerman says she believes the Anchorage Housing First program is working.
Once they can get into permanent housing in places like Carluck and the Juneau program, then they can begin to have a better quality of life. And it looks different for all of them. Some of them, it may just be that they're off the streets and they're surviving, but they're getting meals and we take them to appointments. And others, it may mean that they may do some employment.
Project contractor Jim Triplett says Juneau's building should be finished in about a year. The facility is expected to cost more than $800,000 a year to operate, but more than half of the projected operating costs would come from Alaska Housing Finance Corporation vouchers, rental income, and the Juneau Community Foundation. In Juneau, I'm Rasha McChesney.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The outside view of the Arctic is a place of mythic proportions, fantastical, romantic, and mysterious. Contemporary artists break open the mythical idea of the Arctic in the Anchorage Museum exhibition, A View from Up Here, The Arctic at the Center of the World. Take a revealing look at the Arctic as a place of adaptation, complex landscapes, and diverse people. See The View from Up Here at the Anchorage Museum, open daily 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. This message sponsored by the Anchorage Museum.
Next winter's ferry schedule will be leaner than this year's, and that was pretty lean. It's the result of budget cuts, which could lead to the sale of the ferry Taku. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
This year's ferry schedule includes 356 weeks of sailings, but next year, the number will be down 7% to 330.
What happened this legislative session, I don't like at all.
Dennis Egan is a state senator representing Juneau, Haines, and Skagway, all with strong ferry system connections.
I think it's decimated the marine highway system. And the problem is, a lot of people don't understand that it's a highway. And sure, it costs money to run, but we pay for a lot of it.
Next year's total budget, in its latest version, is almost 10% lower than this year's spending plan. And some of the money will come out of an account that's being spent down quickly. Ferry spokesman Jeremy Woodrow says cuts will be most visible later this year.
It is not the department's intention to change any of the summer schedule. Any changes will be reflected in the winter schedule or next spring and the beginning part of summer 2017.
Five of the Marine Highway's 11 ferries will tie up for much of the fall, winter, spring schedule. That includes both fast ferries, the Kennecott and the Columbia. The other tied-up ferry is the Taku, which hasn't sailed since last July. Woodrow says officials are researching what needs to be done to sell it off, and that's not restricted to outside buyers.
There has been a lot of discussion of different ferry authorities across the Marine Highway System, potentially communities creating their own ferry authorities to improve ferry service. So those are some of the discussions that are being had of what to do with the Taku before it leaves the state of Alaska, if it does indeed leave the state.
Officials say it costs about $3 million a year to lay up the Taku. That covers the skeleton crew, insurance, and fuel for the generators, so selling it off would reduce operating costs. There are other factors, too, such as the ship's age and condition. Ketchikan Representative Dan Ortez, who also represents Wrangell, says he's concerned about the loss of a ship that served Southeast for years.
It's been a mainstay, and while it would require some refurbishment and some significant monies to do that, I want to make sure that in the long run it wouldn't be more cost-effective to do that refurbishment rather than to, say, build another ferry or something like that.
Ferry officials are taking written comments on the fall, winter, spring schedule through June 21st. A teleconference is planned for the following day. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
Nearly 16 years ago, Mike Daniel and his wife decided to adopt from the foster care system. They are white. The children they adopted are black. This is the story of Mike and his oldest son, Nathan. Nathan was 2 years old when he was adopted. Part of their conversation contains a racial slur that may be objectionable to some listeners.
There's a little bit of apprehension, just in more feeling like whether or not we'd be accepted by the black community, and recognizing that there's a lot of pride and a lot of interest in keeping them within their culture. And so there's a lot of concern for me just to feel like whether or not we'd measure up in their eyes.
It never really occurred to me that I was a different race than my parents. Not until I was much older. Like, once I got into like school, like second grade, people would point it out to me. They're like, why is your dad white and why are you black? And I didn't really have a way to explain it back then. It was just like, I don't know, it's just the way it is. And everyone thought it was so weird.
You know, and they'd ask the why questions, right? And I mean, he's my son, it doesn't matter what color he is, right? But they just recognized it as being different.
Like, as I got older, I started feeling more alienated just because it was a strange sort of, they didn't associate me and my parents as part of the same family. It was I was the black person and they were the white people. It makes you definitely feel different, like not only in a bad or a good way, but it just points it out to you. And then, you know, you gotta kind of think like, yeah, I am not the same race as my parents. And,
you know, and these guys were our early elementary age and were walking through a mall. The place is packed, and the level of like sense that you were the spectacle was so overwhelming, and actually to the point of hearing among just all the noise of the busyness of that place, younger adults, teenagers from that area that were actually making racial comments as we'd pass them, you know, like really degrading, you know, things like spear chucker, all sorts of really, really like hurtful things, to the point where as a parent, all I wanted to do, like I had so much anger to just, I think about it later and just have sort of the shame of thinking about all I wanted to do is pummel these kids, right? Because they just needed to recognize the hurt that they were causing.
I'm becoming more proud of my race, but it's also hard because I don't act like the stereotypical black person. Part of that may be because I was raised by white people and I don't take any shame in that. But it's when people go, wow, you don't really act like a black person. It makes me more conscious of the fact that I don't. I might look like it, but I don't act like it. I spent a lot of time like listening to black people talk because I wanted to try to sound like them. This was like back in like middle school. sometimes I accident, like unconsciously talk like that when I meet a new black person. I don't know why I do it. I think it's a bit of a fear thing, but like that's something I'll do. Most of the time with white people, I just get apprehensive. Like, are they gonna think it's weird? But with black people, it's the time I change my attitude because I want to fit in a bit more, I think. But at the same time, I've also sometimes wanted to be more white in other respects. Because you fit in more when you're more white, but you can be more part of your heritage when you're more black. It's a crossroads, really.
I want him to feel confident in himself and who he is and that there's value there. I've tried to sort of talk through the process of when you go somewhere, people are going to make certain assumptions about who you are. And I could almost guarantee that the picture that they'll have in their mind will not be white parents in sheltered Anchorage, Alaska. And so there's going to be some things that you're going to have to understand how people are going to see you.
Like a lot of times, like you turn on the news and you see like the stuff that happens to, you know, young black men, and the disconnect of me a lot of times forgetting that I am black. And the fact that it could happen to me and I could not even really be thinking about it. And that, you know, if I'm walking down the street with my hands in my pockets and like my hood up and someone says like, that's a black person doing that, like they don't know that this is my dad. They're expecting a completely different scenario. And the fact that I gotta be ready, like I have to, no matter how much I'd like to live my life a certain way, like there are things I have to prepare myself for in, you know, the real kind of nasty world. I think it's really hard to prepare somebody for like going out into that kind of world, like a world that doesn't know itself what it thinks of race, and is uncertain, is as uncertain as I am about what it means to be a certain race. I think that's it's really hard for a parent to like, for any parent to fully 100% make sure their kid's ready. And a lot of that's, it's on me, like it's on in my ability to feel good about myself or who I am.
Mike and his son Nathan Daniel spoke with Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman about being an interracial family. If you're in Anchorage, you can continue the conversation about race during Community in Unity at 7 p.m. on Wednesday in the Alaska Public Media Studios. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholtz, Rasha McChesney, Ed Schoenfeld, and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Robert Hannon in Fairbanks, Tim Bodoni in Galena, and Ann Hillman in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence,
and by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Alaska Native elders and Arctic scientists explore climate change at Signs of the Land Camp in Fairbanks, June 14 to 17. Travel grant deadline May 24 at ainealaska.org. This message sponsored by the Association of Interior Native Educators. Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org, where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.